Welcome to this very special edition of the KJ Masterclass Live, the show which ensures that you profit from your time spent here with experts, either through the industry insights, information, or simply learning from them. And today we have Mike Hammond. He is a retired homicide detective with the Chicago Police Department, and also now he is a podcast host. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thank you very much, Ajit. It's great to be here.
You're welcome to the show, Mike. You are welcome to India in this online form. And I'm sure not just in India, but a lot of people across the globe will benefit from what we are going to talk about. We'll talk about your life as a detective, and we'll try and understand the complexities of homicide investigations. So first, my first question is, before I come to your journey, one thing I want to understand from your life as a detective, as a police person, is that whenever you crack a big case, whenever you are able to solve it, does it come as a sort of victory to you, or is it more of a relief? Because the bigger the case, bigger the realization what our society has come to. And that is perhaps. So I want to understand your feeling about whenever you look at cases, whenever it is solved, whether it's more of relief, more of victory. Help us understand that.
Sure. I mean, I it's mostly relief, because you want answers for the victim, the victim's family, mostly. There are times where you do feel kind of a sense of victory, because some cases are very difficult to solve and take years. I worked on cases for 9 or 10 years before I got an answer as to who the killer was. And in some of those cases, it feels a little like victory, like you're, really accomplished something. In general, it's just relief, because you're really trying to get answers for the victim's family.
Right, Mike. Now, help us understand, take us through a bit of your journey about why you came into the police department. Initially, everyone looks for a job. Was it more for the job, and then you started liking the job, or was it your mission to join the police forces?
Yeah, it was more of a mission for me, I think, because when I was about 16 or 17 years old, I read a book by Truman Capote called In Cold Blood, and it's based on a true story, and it just, something touched me in it, and I really just kind of decided at that time I could have articulated that I wanted to be a homicide detective, but I knew that I couldn't just sit back and watch. I needed to get answers. Then as I got a little older, I went to college. I started to figure out, this is what I want to do. And then I really pursued it and got in the police department. And then I was a policeman, patrolman in uniform for about 6 years. And then detective in Chicago is a tested position. So they give a test. And I studied hard for the test and did well and made detective. So I kind of had a path,
Right, Mike. You are in the police department as a detective also for quite a number of years. What is the day like in the life of a detective? How do you plan it beforehand? Are things are very much planned, or you just take it as it comes? How does it work? Help us understand, so that I don't know even about India, but I want to understand through you, for a lot of people who want to understand, how does a Chicago police detective actually work?
Yeah, so I mean, especially after you have been a detective for a few years, you always kind of have a plan of what you want to get done on your case, because Chicago is a pretty violent city. We have a number of murders, so it's never quiet, right? We always have cases coming. And then, so for the most part, I'd have a list of things, list of open cases I was working on all the time. And so every day, I'd have kind of a list of cases that were closer to being solved, trying to get those things done, and then work my way down the list. But always, every day you went to work was a new challenge, because no matter what your plan was, if we're short of people or everybody got busy and a new murder came in, you might get a new murder assigned to you that day you go in. So It's kind of, yeah, you try and go in with a plan every day on the cases that you're working on. And sometimes it works out, but sometimes, you know, you have to take what comes in, you know?
Right, right. And is it like in the Hollywood movies that we get an impression, okay, such is the way the detectives work, or is it much different or quite similar to that? How would you like to help us understand from the real part of how it works on the ground?
You know, it's quite a bit different, really. I mean, there are parts of it. Some movies can catch things fairly accurately in small pieces, but, you know, Hollywood has to make things interesting and tell a story in 2 hours, right? So actual detective work is much more of a time-consuming, grinding kind of work where you have to – a lot of reports, a lot of time interviewing people, a lot of looking over evidence. It's not so much as, you know, driving the fast cars and getting in the shootouts all the time. You know, that's more of the movies. So it's quite a bit different just in terms of the actual work that has to be done. And sometimes, you know, movies will get some things right. But you know, the most, in my opinion, always the most important trait to have as a good homicide detective is the ability to talk to people and to get people comfortable talking to you, whether that's a killer or a witness or, you know, whatever it is. You need to be able to get them to kind of be motivated to talk to you and be able to listen, not just to what they're saying, but how they're saying it. And all those little nuances are really important. And that's much more important than being like Sherlock Holmes, you know, who can, you know, I deduct that. Yeah, that doesn't, it's not really, it doesn't come up that much really where you're, you know.
Right, right. Now from the life of a detective, say 10 years earlier on and on today, is it much more easy with so much of technology in hand, or is it difficult in today's time? Because then there is technology again involved in today's time.
You know, technology for the most part is a really big help. Things like, you know, in the early 1990s, we started really understanding DNA and how DNA worked in like probative evidential way, right? And so that really opened a lot of doors. That was like fingerprints that were much more definitive. So, but also things like, you know, when I first made detective, it was very unusual to find video cameras on the scene of your murder, unless it happened like in a store at a gas station or something like that. There wasn't video. Now there's video cameras everywhere. People have them on their homes, on their doorbells. So in a city like Chicago, there's not too many places you can go and not be on video, right? So that really helps, you know, in homicide investigations. So technology has significantly helped. Now, is the job gotten easier? I don't know about that, because the politics and stress on policemen and the number of people who left creates kind of a manpower shortage, which puts more pressure on the people actually working. So that's harder. But the technology aspect is a big benefit for sure.
Right, right. And how much is the interference or involvement, you know, from, say, from bureaucracy or, yep, or even the senior police officer? Obviously, that will come from outside. Then it boils down to the people on the ground, comes down to the... And also in terms of politics and politicians, how much is that? How have you understood it in your day-to-day work?
You know, in the day-to-day kind of work of being a homicide detective, it doesn't affect you a lot, but over the course of time, politics can affect a lot, because if, you know, the city is getting sued a lot by over policemen doing things, if, you know, you'll get this pressure from the politicians down to high level policemen that, you know, they want things done in a different way. They don't want certain things done because of the way it looks, the optics of politics, you know, that is not helpful, because, you know, solving murders is, you know, pretty linear. Like, we're trying to get information and try and find out the truth of what happened. And when people come in and try and influence it from the outside, it's not good. But I would say, you know, mostly you don't feel that in the day-to-day working of homicide cases. It's kind of more of the long-term big picture where it becomes a problem. Like, as an example, I mentioned earlier, we're short-staffed and they're trying to do more work with less detectives through budgets and the politics of, you know, the pressure put on policemen. And so that is a thing that does affect the job pretty severely for a homicide detective trying to do his job, because now, instead of catching maybe one or two murders or maybe three murders in a month, you might be catching one a week, and every one takes so much work that it's harder to give each case, you know, the attention it needs. It would be wrong for me to say that it plays no part, because it does play some. But, you know, again, on the day-to-day operations, if I got a job to do, I got a murder to solve, you don't feel it as much, you know?
Right. What about organized crime? Because then they have got long arms, just like the police has long arms. They have got also long arms, and they have got a lot of influence, money, power also. How does that work? Has it worked? Has it come to you? Have you faced it? Second thing is, has that pressure of either the pressure of solving a case or either to, you know, get someone exonerated, they force someone else to be implicated? Help us understand this sort of this murky business that we keep on, and we get to see this. It's a reality of life, but I want to understand from your eyes with as much openness that is you can afford to, you know, bring.
Sure. Well, I'll start with organized crime. You know, we do have organized crime here in Chicago in a lot of different ways, right? We have, you know, what people consider like the old school mafia, like, you know, it wasn't all Italian, but people think of it as like the Italian mafia. They're not very active anymore. A lot of those, you know, big time bosses have gotten old and gone to prison, and the younger people, there's too much pressure from the federal government to arrest them. So they're not as active anymore, but we have organized crime in terms of gangs, you know, drug sales, all of that is also kind of an organized crime situation. And yeah, they have the money to try and influence. It doesn't, the way it affects a homicide detective is, you know, it's not like they're coming to me to threaten me or to try and pay me off or anything like that. The way they can influence it is try and scare or pay off witnesses not to cooperate. You know, things like that, that can make it difficult. And that's why, you know, those type of murders are more difficult to get someone charged. And make sure that you have the right person, that you don't get, some gang trying to get an opposing gang member put in prison for a murder that they didn't do, you just have to be really careful and thorough in your investigation and make sure everything kind of, you know, supports itself. But yeah, I mean, in the gangs and, you know, drug sales, organized crime, it's still prevalent and makes cases very difficult to solve at times, you know?
Right. Right, Mike. You talked about drugs. Drugs is a big problem across the globe. In some places, it's much more. We all understand that these things cannot be, you know, done without the support of powerful people, either it be politicians or bureaucrats or whoever it is. Many a times you are able to crack a case, but it might be at a lower level. Now people get an impression that in US, everyone is equal before the law. We see this case of Trump, the case being filed against Trump and other cases. So we get that impression. Does it actually work on the ground like that? Because at the end of the day, you might be only able to catch the guy who has done things on the ground, either to a greater degree, but the people who have actually, who are the kingpins, who are the ones who are controlling everything, including some powerful people in politics. Do you ever get that feeling that you're only able to do, say, some part of the case? The actual people have never been caught, will never get caught. And that is the real reason where it is, you know, leading to much, much, much problem across the world. Do you get, I want to understand, does it lead to a bit of frustration? Because you want to do it, but the system is more powerful than you are. I want to understand, is law really the same for everyone?
You know, kind of murders are a different game in that, you know, it, for the purposes of homicide detective, if you kill somebody and it's not justified, you know, it's not self-defense or something, but you kill an innocent person or a person, you know, that shouldn't have been killed, even if they're, one gang member shooting another gang member, you know, it's still a murder, and you have to preserve. For us, it's the same, and it doesn't really matter if it's a wealthy person or a poor gang member. The investigation is the same, and you're doing the same type of thing. But what you can't deny here is that once it gets to the court system, people with money, no matter their race or their religion or anything else, if they have money, then they are going to be better off in the court system because they have the ability to pay, you know, more sophisticated lawyers who have connections and that can really know how to try a case, the ability to kind of try and negotiate better terms for, you know, prison time, things like that. So I do believe that there's still an inequality in terms of, you know, like the court systems. And also, I mean, you know, I don't know how it is in India, but here, I mean, the great deal of our violence is still in the poor communities. And, you know, revolves around drug use, drug sales, all of that, control of drug money, all of those things. And so poor people still bear the brunt of the criminal justice system more than wealthy people, you know, even though, as we see, you know, we see all over the world, we see here, there are wealthy people not committing murders, but they're committing crimes, high crimes sometimes, you know, embezzlement and theft and all of the bad business dealings and, you know, even into like high level drug dealing. It's harder to prosecute those cases. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't I don't think it would be fair for me to say that, I know it's all equal. Everybody's treated the same. I like to think as a homicide detective, when you get a murder, everybody's equal. Everybody's life has value, right? No matter whether who the victim was. We hear this a lot, like, well, we don't, prostitute gets murdered and we don't investigate it as hard because she was living a high risk lifestyle. That's not my experience. My experience was you try and solve them all. Now some are more difficult, in that particular example, those are more difficult to solve because a girl's out by herself meeting multiple people. It could be a more difficult case to solve, but it's not like we're trying any, putting less effort into it. We want to solve them.
Right, Mike. Now, when does a case go cold? Is it a time frame that you have, or is it just like, you think that you have tried enough and then you just put it in the back burner?
Yeah, so I would say it's interesting. I worked in a cold case homicide unit for about 2 or 3 years. And in the city of Chicago, there's no time frame. Like, I would look at cases that were only 6 months old, and I looked at some cases that are 60 years old, The way we define a case going cold is all active leads that can be pursued in the case have kind of dried up. There's no active thing going on where the detectives who had the original case can still pursue it, So then they move on to the next case because they've got other things going. There are jurisdictions in this country that do have time limits. Like they say, once a case is a year old and, nothing's been done, then it's deemed a cold case. We don't really do that in Chicago. It's more about the logistics of the case. And, all the other thing real quickly, when I worked in cold case, I wasn't being assigned new murders. So it was a luxury because that I could take a case, even though it was old, but I could just focus on that case, put all my energy on that case. And so that's really helpful, especially in cities like Chicago, where we're so busy. So I would have like friends of mine who are detectives still working active cases who'd call me and say, hey, look, Mike, I'm so busy, but I have this case that's like 6 months old and it's this close to getting solved. I just need to get these things done, but I can't do it because I keep catching new murders. And they knew I had the time. So then I'd say, yeah, so give me the file, and then I would do the work to get it to the point, okay, we're ready to charge the case now. We got the bad guy identified. We've done all the evidential work. We're ready to charge it. Then I bring those detectives back in and we kind of finish it, together. But cold case here is more of a, there's no definitive time on it at all. But that's not true in the whole country, like I said.
Right, Mike. Now, talking of cold cases itself, in some cases where the family of the victim, they are in touch with, say, detectives, how do you deal with those people who continue to be in touch to understand if there is something happening in their cases? How does it feel? Do you feel helpless? Do you feel taking an emotional toll on even you people, because you need to tell them something? There is, and they are expecting something, waiting for that closure for themselves. How does that work? How did it work for you?
Yeah, so that's a really good point. I often tell people, to me, the hardest part about being a homicide detective was dealing with the victims' families, because I always gave a lot of access of myself to the families, because, I think, they have the right to it. And then also, sometimes the family is just going to hear things about the case that we don't hear. And if I don't have a relationship with them, or they don't trust me and think I'm, you know, taking the case seriously, working hard on the case, they might not tell me. So I always maintain those relationships. It is hard, though, because then you have to accept those 2 a.m. phone calls from the victim's mother who just wants to grieve. And, you know, sometimes they're angry. You know, why is nothing being done? Why? And sometimes they're thankful. Like, I know it's hard. I'm so thankful that you're still working on it. And sometimes they don't want to talk about the case at all. They just want to grieve. And you have to let them. Now, there are some detectives that don't do that. And I understand why, because they're, you know, kind of 2 schools of thought. You either like do it like I did and allow yourself a lot of access to the family, or you try and maintain a real kind of a delineation line of, all right, this is the case I'm working. I'm going to deal with the family when I need to. I'll talk to them when I need to. I'll return calls when they call and give them, you know, the information they asked for. But other than that, I'm not going to. And I'm not saying that's wrong. You could argue maybe that might be the better way to go. But for me, and what worked for me was having this relationships with the victim's family. And does it take a toll on you? It certainly does. It really does. I think for after 16 years of it, that's what wore me down the most. Even though the families were, from by and large, were really good to deal with. I mean, especially based on the incredible trauma that they had been through. But that kind of weight of dealing with and talking to them all the time, talking to people who are grieving all the time, was, yeah, it was a lot for sure.
Right, Mike. So one thing I want to understand for the audience is that, as a simple person living a simple life, how can I minimize my, you know, risk of being a victim? Because I'm not even if I don't go out on the street, even at home, I can have all the dangers, including use of my laptop or anything, because from a pedophile to anyone, they can reach out to me, either in terms of my online security, to everything, to even egging people to commit, you know, self-harm. I want to understand that. Where do I go as an individual? How do I minimize that risk of becoming a victim?
Well, so it's a good question. I think, you know, it starts with the basics of not trying your best to not put yourself in a high risk position, right? And understanding if your surroundings. So, as a, you know, like the generation of people older than me, my grandmother, my father, people like that, they always say nothing good happens after midnight, right? Should be home. And you know, I guess that's largely true. A lot of bad stuff does happen late at night. But let's say you've got a job where you don't get off work until after midnight, right? And you still got to get home. Well, you got to be aware of that and cognizant of the fact, okay, it's a little higher risk because I've got to take the train or the bus, you know, at this late hour. So you need to be aware of your surroundings. And I tell people all the time, like, animals survive on instinct. They don't have reason, you know. They can't reason away things. They survive on instinct. They feel when a predator is in the area and they move away or they run away. Well, we have instincts too, but we, you know, as we get more sophisticated and all that, we get further and further away from our instincts, but they're still there. And I learned a long time ago as a policeman, like, that little voice in my head told me, ooh, be careful. Don't shut it off. Don't try and rationalize it. Listen to it and say, and I try and get people, everybody, to do that. You get a feeling something's not right, assume it's not right, right? Everybody's been in that situation where I'm like, something doesn't feel right here. You're on the train, you're waiting on the bus, or you're at a party, or whatever it is, and something doesn't feel right. And you know, the nature of the way we are now, we're kind of trying to rationalize, oh, it's just me, everything looks fine, or I don't want to be prejudiced against anybody, or that's not the way to be. The way to be is listen to that voice and move away, get away, get yourself out of that situation, whatever you need to do that. Be aware, you know, I mean, that's the biggest thing. If something doesn't feel right, assume it's not right, and then remove yourself from it. Inside of your own home, I mean, I think, you know, every person's home is their castle, right? So you need to be, certainly with computers and technology, you need to be very, very careful. But once again, like, you know, if it doesn't feel right, if something doesn't look right, it's maybe it's not leave it. You know what I mean? You get email and it's something doesn't feel right. And I know a lot of elderly people get stuck in these scams, right? Where they get email saying we're from your bank and, you know, there's a problem with your account. And like, you know, a lot of us see that and think, well, this doesn't even look like my bank, and my bank would never ask me for my password. You know what I mean? Like kind of understand that, but some people don't, especially elderly people sometimes. And to just have to kind of educate everybody, be aware that, you know, there are people out there trying to cause harm, whether that's physical harm or whether it's financial harm or reputation harm, whatever it is. So be aware and treat everything that way. Be careful of what you're doing online. Make sure what you're doing is, you know, makes sense to what you're trying to accomplish at that time. I just think that's the biggest and most important thing anybody can do for their own safety is be aware of your surroundings and listen to that little voice in your head that's telling you, you know, that's been telling human beings since, you know, we were on the earth and huge lions were chasing people around, like, ooh, there's that probably a lion here. I, you know, something's not right. I got to get out of here. Right. So it hasn't changed. We just have gotten away from it, or we rationalize it away. And that's, I encourage people to not do that. Listen, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There is much to learn from you. One last thing I want to understand, at the end of the day, after seeing going to a violent scene and getting that burden on your mind, trying to think about it all the time, how do you then, you know, go back to your family with so much of mind? And even a bigger thing is, how do you go back to being yourself? Because that's also very important. What's the trick? Did you adopt? How others can adopt?
It's not easy. I think the trick is, and I think that this just part of this just comes with seasoning and time in doing it, an age where you start to understand that, you know, if I'm not taking care of my own mental health, then I'm not going to be helpful to anybody else. But it's very difficult. I mean, it is, because you see such horrible things that it is really hard. And I don't want to get too graphic for your audience, but I'll just make it simple. I mean, every murder that I worked on that involved a child, it's hard not to look at that child like you and equate them to your own children if you have them, right? And so you just have to, so it makes you want to go home and cling to your own children harder, right? And make sure they're safe and feel that safety. But you kind of got to work through that. You don't want to put the pressure on your own family that you're feeling from what you do at work. And I'll be honest, I'm not telling you I always did that perfectly. My kids might tell you that it was, you know, we're very close, but they might tell you it wasn't a lot of fun a lot of times having dad as a homicide detective, you know. But you have to be aware. You have to tend to your own mental health, do the things. I always nurtured the relationships I had with people outside of the police department, you know, so that when I wasn't working, I wasn't like talking about police work all the time with people or things, even though I had great friends on the police department. I just, you know, sometimes you just want to talk about football or, you know, baseball, or you got to let that go, you know? And that's the trick. And then the bigger issue is when it starts, and it does happen to anybody who does it very long, because just the nature of the violence and the horrors that you see and dealing with victims, at some point it becomes too much. You don't, I just don't think people are built to be able to absorb all that all the time. So then at that point, you have to reach out, have the awareness to reach out to somebody else. That's a therapist, or, you know, your religious, you know, your priest or your, you know, religious leader in your community, and just say, I'm having a hard time. I'm having a hard time, and talk about it. And because you can't, we have way too many policemen that commit suicide, that have, you know, drink too much, have divorces and all of that. And it's related to the stress of the job and managing that stress. And it's like another full-time job, just managing all of the things in your life, you know, and the stress. So, but it can be done. I mean, I feel like I went through a whole lot of stress in those years, but I still, I love the job, and I can still look out and see a beautiful sky and enjoy, you know, a beautiful art. It didn't warp me too badly. But it takes work.
There is much to learn from you, Mike, and I'm sure this is just one episode. You have a podcast of your own, Detective Story with Mike Hammond. Tell us about that so that people can learn about all these things from you.
Sure. Thank you for mentioning it. Yeah, it's my daughter really pushed me to kind of do that, because she loves like true crime stories and podcasts, you know, and a lot of her friends. And she's like, Dad, I listen to these podcasts and they're interesting, but they don't have your perspective. They don't have your kind of background and knowledge. And I think that it would be really interesting for you to do that. She worked on me for a while, and then I started listening to some of them I understood, you know. The people doing these podcasts would be asking questions like, I don't understand why the police did this at this time, or why they didn't do this at that time. And I'd be thinking, hey, well, I know the answer to that off the top of my head, you know. So, you know, I had to kind of figure out how I would do it, how I could put myself out there without hurting, you know, the people I worked with or some of the cases I worked on and all that stuff. And then what I decided to do, the best way to approach it was to make it about the victims and the, you know, kind of keep their name alive. And some of the cases I solved, some of them are still open. I talked to the victims' families, and I'm pleasantly surprised how encouraged they are to talk to me, because they like to keep their, you know, a loved one's name alive. Or if the case hasn't solved, they're, you know, hopeful somebody will, you know, step forward. So that's kind of been the focus, making it about the victims and, you know, telling the story of some of my investigations. Like, if you really want to know, like, how does investigation play out from start to finish, you know, I kind of lay that out in my show.
Wonderful. So for all those people who would like to connect with you, learn more about you, learn more about your podcast, what's the best way for them to do so?
So the best way is my podcast email, and it's just mike@detectivestory.net, which is listed, you know, in my podcast notes. But yeah, anybody wants to email me, I will get back and answer any questions you have. I like the interaction, so that's the best way to get a hold of me.
Wonderful. With this, it's a wrap on this very special edition of the KJ Masterclass Live. Thank you so much indeed for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.